Blog Talk Radio.
Good morning. This is Walter Davis with the San Diego County Community Coalition radio channel and Media Communications Association International, Los Angeles and Orange County chapter radio channel. And this morning we have the distinct pleasure to have Dr. David Imhotep, and he's from Roanoke, Virginia. And he is the first person to hold a PhD with a specialization in ancient African history. He has traveled the world researching for the last 30 years, searching for relevant, interesting evidence. He's appeared on television, radio, and magazines and newspapers such as the New York Times. And he has lectures that are filled with cutting-edge data and that are actually entertaining in terms of addressing his claim that the first Americans were Africans, and that's documented in his book. Welcome aboard, Dr. Imhotep.
Thank you very much for having me.
It's certainly a pleasure to have you. So we'll just go and dive right into it. So a lot of people would, you know, say that this claim that the first Americans were Africans, they would claim that that's not true. And so tell me about that. Tell me about your certification or your education and being the first person to have a PhD in those studies.
Well, my school that I graduate from is accredited. It is a university in Cincinnati. It is Union Institute and University. I graduated in 2008 with that degree, and I have had the wonderful pleasure of creating a dissertation which was showing that the Egyptian people of the Egyptian empire, and I say empire, the title of it was the people of the Nile Valley, specifically Egypt, predated the people of the Mesopotamian Valley, Tigris-Euphrates Valley, specifically Sumer, tens of thousands of years. And in that dissertation, I was starting to speak to this subject, but it got so broad, whereas I would have been out of field if I had continued. So I said, I'll shelf that, put it on the shelf for later, and that's what I did. So I wrote this book because of that reason.
I see. So tell me about your background in education.
I was on a football scholarship to University of Nebraska at Omaha. I transferred then to University of Maryland for my last 3 years. It's kind of cold out there. and finished my football career there. My degree was in business management, and then I went and went for my first love, nutrition, and got a degree in nutrition at Ansbach University. It was a master's and then a PhD, and I had a few famous clients. The most famous was Muhammad Ali. Worked for him for his last five fights. And then I went to Florida and wanted to open up a nutrition business, which that's what I did. But after a few years, Florida made a law that you could not prescribe. Even if someone came to you and said, I have a headache, and you said, you can take an aspirin, that's prescribing, and I could have lost my license. So I saw it was a dead end. And I changed back in the early 90s to this field, history. And it got so broad, and I loved it so much, I started wanting to go to school. So that's what I did. I went to school and kept going till I finished my PhD degree, which is the highest level that I could go. And now I'm out teaching and writing books and researching and traveling the world.
I see. So you're the first person to actually hold this PhD in the world.
That's correct. I created the field with my board and people that would help me, and a few people from other places other than Union Institute and university, and also people within that university. My board helped me with this endeavor, which was quite. It took approximately a year to put this together, to write my practicum and said that it was a practical venture to open up. There's the African American field was opened up by Malefi Asante at Temple. He created the first a PhD program there at Temple, and this is what I hope to do somewhere else: create the first PhD program in ancient African studies at some university or college.
I see. Now, why is it that you think we don't have a real intensified study of ancient African history in our education system in this country?
I'd say it would be mostly political, and I stay in my lane, I stay in my field. I am not a politician. I do not want to be a politician, and I will never be one. I stay in my field, which is history, specifically ancient African history, from the time period of Egypt backwards. The question was, again, what
was the question? Why is it that, in other words, you're the first person to have an advanced degree like this in ancient African history? It seems like that would be more widespread. What are some of the reasons here in America we don't really have a serious focus widespread on ancient African history? Why is that?
It's probably for the same reason why the HBCUs, historically black colleges and universities, are being, I wouldn't say attacked, definitely not attacked on the surface, but they are having trouble financially because of certain other reasons, which I don't want to get into and start a political show here. I'm here for history. But I would say for the same reason that it's political, and everyone knows what that is, and I just rather not go into that.
Okay. Well, then we'll just go into the controversial items. Would you like to discuss the controversial items that this book addresses?
Absolutely, sir.
All right. So the first statement: in February 2010, the New York Times newspaper reported humans have been sailing for 130,000 years, according to evidence found on the island of Crete in the Mediterranean Sea.
That's correct. So that shows that human beings have been sailing for at least 130,000 years, because they found that was a sustained civilization there on Crete, and Crete is in the middle of the Mediterranean. It was not connected with the other land masses for millions of years. So the only way to approach Crete would be by sea, through the Mediterranean Sea. So in order to get to Crete and go back, you had to have some kind of, not just a vessel, but navigational knowledge. So we're talking about 130,000 years ago, they know that there were people on Crete. So to get to out of the Mediterranean Sea across Atlantic in America, people from the Nile Valley would have had 70,000 more years to be able to do that. And I think within 70,000 years more of sailing, I think it's very, very, very possible. And the evidence shows that they did indeed reach all three Americas.
Okay. And Africans began sailing to the Americas by 60,000 years ago.
56,000 is the safest figure, but I say at least 56,000, possibly not just 60, but possibly even 80 or 90,000 years ago, maybe even 100. But we have documented proof. Documented evidence. See, we don't talk in my field, in science, we don't talk about proof and truth, because it was true that it rained yesterday, but it's also true that today it's not raining. So truth and facts change. So you must base your work on evidence. Evidence never changes. So my evidence for this topic is I have my thesis, which is the exact same as title as the title of my book, The First Americans Were Africans, Documented Evidence. The documented evidence comes in many forms, but the best form is that I have, it's based on 7 and soon to be 8 peer-reviewed journal articles. And that is solid, solid. All I needed was 1, 2, maybe 3, but I went overboard because this is such a controversial subject. I want it to be airtight, and that's what it is now. It's airtight. 7 to 8 peer-reviewed journal articles support my thesis. That is spelled out in my book where I got them from, and anyone is free to see or free to look into that to see if I quoted them correctly or if they are what they say they are.
I see. And the next statement is the first Asians entered North America in 3000 BCE.
Mm-hmm. This is such an incredible subject. In my book, I talk about Clovis, and everyone knows Clovis, and this was a standard genre of academia that, you know, the Asians walked over into the Americas 10, 15, even as many as 15, 16,000 years ago. But Clovis, they say they were there at least by 9,000 BC. Well, this is kind of funny because that route was closed for 150,000 years and didn't begin to open around 8,000 BC. Didn't begin to open. It wasn't even all the way up until a few thousand years after 8,000 BC. And why is that? There's a dissertation that speaks to that I quote in my book, and it talks about how the that area, Beringia, which is the area between Alaska and Eastern Asia, today's Russia, was blocked by icebergs and by a large, a very, very large iceberg. I would say they said it was between 1 and 2 miles high. And what we're told was that these Mongolians or these Asians, if you were, crossed over following herds of beasts. Well, if they're following a carnivorous animal, the carnivorous animal is looking for other animals to eat, and the herbivorous herbivores who are looking for different herbs and seeds and leaves and whatnot to eat. But these things don't grow in ice. So there was nothing for the animals to eat. Therefore, the animals would not have taken this route, and there's nothing for the people to eat. And they would have gone on a journey approximately 1,500 or so miles without seeing anything green. So these people are in the same idea as I am, and that is that if they did cross, they did not cross that way. So then you have another theory that came up was, well, maybe they came up around the beaches, on the beaches. Well, I don't know if anyone has ever seen a commercial on television advertising these cruises they have to Alaska. Uh-huh. I know I sparked some people's memories there, because it is vivid that I saw at the coastline of Alaska, some parts of Alaska, there are ice mounds maybe 200-300 yards high right now, and they showed pictures of them, of some of them melting and falling into the water. So that is unlikely that they came that way as well. Well, then they have the third theory maybe they came from Australia because they found some black bones there. But going to Australia, I'll say the black bones were in South America, by the way, of Africans, Africoids. And that route is approximately 6,500 miles from South America to Australia. But if you look in the east of the east, east from South America, the closest portion to from Africa, say from Ghana or whatnot, to South America, specifically Brazil, is only 1,500 miles. So you're talking about it six times closer. So they're trying desperately to find people to come from Asia or from the Orient or to skip the islands across down under in Australia or anywhere they want them to come but Africa. And this I find most troubling.
And we have a caller on the line right now. I believe this is Elise Smith Cooper.
That's Elise? Correct. I am on. Yes. Can you hear me?
Yeah, you're kind of garbled. But did you have a question for David? Elise? Okay, we're not able to hear Elise speaking right now, but so, Dr. Imhotep, the next statement that I have is that the first documented Caucasians, the Vikings, entered the Americas around 1000 AD.
Well, were we able to have any pictures up? Because I had I have a picture here of the evidence, the stone tools that they were making in Crete. Did you have that available?
Well, yeah, there are pictures up that are changing. There's a collage of pictures that you sent me, and I put those up, but they're changing, automatically.
Oh, I see. Okay, fine. Okay, and you asked me about the Vikings now?
Yes.
Okay, the Vikings, this is a very, very fun story. The first documented Caucasians to reach the Americas was, of course, the Vikings, and that was around between 800 and 1200 A.D., so we'll just say 1000 A.D. And this is when they meet some other people when they get there, of course, and they met the Indians. But the Indians they found were not only Africans, but they were short Africans. And to them, they called them ugly short Africans, and they named them Skraelings, S-K-R-A-L-I-N-G-S. And what they did was they started trading with these Africans, but these were Vikings, so you must know that after a while, the trading changed into something else, and they did what the Vikings have done all the way up and down the coast of Europe into the Mediterranean. That is, rob, steal, kill, rape, murder, etc. And these guys are the descendants of the Anu and the Twa, who are 3.5 to 4.5 feet tall. But they were numerous, and they had some a few weapons that were a little advanced. The Vikings, they had these poison blow darts, and they also had a net that they would put in bones and sharp rocks and et cetera, and they would launch them, and it would come down like a mortar shell. Well, that along with them calling their cousins and brothers and whatnot from far away, and these Vikings were hopelessly outnumbered. So after a while, the Vikings pulled up stakes and they left. And they when they went back to Europe, they must have told the people in Europe to watch out for going over there, because from 1000 BC to 1492, they didn't come back. So no Europeans came back until around Columbus's time, 1492, which is 2,092 years later.
Okay, so I'm going to try to see if we can get Elise back on again. We had trouble with her microphone earlier, so hold on a second. Okay, Elise, can you hear
can
us?
Can you hear me now?
Yes.
Can you hear me now?
Yes.
Well, good morning.
Good morning.
Good morning, Dr. Imhotep.
Good morning.
I'm delighted to be able to hear of this information. And I can understand why it has not been made more widely known.
Uh-huh.
But can you describe a little bit more of the Africoid people that were found there by the Vikings? What was their culture like? Do we have any information?
Oh, yes, we do. They had a culture that was kind of advanced, especially in their architecture. They had mounds. They were the mound builders, and I won't get to that until my host wants to get into that, but these were people who up there in Canada were building mounds, and some of them were very large, and they were not just dirt mounds that were dirt piled on top of each other, but they were mounds that were built on top of a stone skeleton. We're talking about gigantic, multi-ton stones that would, you know, how you build a card house with a deck of cards. You have cards that are the first level are two cards that are vertical, and then you put a card horizontal. That is the way they built. They had two vertical slabs, and in the small ones they would just put a horizontal one, but on to hold the dirt. But if they had a very large dome of this, even a slab of a couple tons thick could not hold the tonnage of weight of dirt on top of it. So they went back to their stores of knowledge, and they built the exact same type of roof that is built in ancient Egypt. Okay, they built a corbelled vaulted ceiling. Corbelled vaulted ceiling is like this. You have, just imagine the two walls on either side, and you put up on top of that wall resting a long stone, say the shape of a railroad tie. Then the next one you put on top of there, you have a few inches more towards the center, but it's still balanced. Then you have another one a few inches more to the center, and what you're building actually is it looks like a triangle, a stone pyramid. And then at the top, it's joined by capstone. So what happens is all the weight that is put on there is pushed out laterally instead of vertically. So what they had was they had these type of mounds in Canada, this type of advanced architecture, the same exact architecture that you'll find in the Grand Galley. I've been there in Egypt, in Giza, in the Temple of Giza. The Pyramid of Giza. And in the Grand Galley, as you look up, that is the exact same ceiling. So they borrowed from their cousins or whomever you wanted to say in Egypt. That goes back tens of thousands of years ago as well. The Great Pyramid, they say, is 3,000, 2,000 B.C. That is a large controversy that has been proven wrong as well. So we won't get into that. That's a side issue. But, yes, it was a slightly advanced culture that they went into seeing. And they were advanced in some fields, more advanced than the Vikings, and not as advanced as the Vikings in other fields.
Okay. And so your next.
You want to go further with the Vikings, their helmet, or would you want to go?
Sure, go ahead. This is your discussion. You take it the direction
All right.
you want to go.
Okay. The most recognizable icon that you see in the Viking would be what? When you imagine a Viking, what is the most famous icon or piece of clothing or something that he wears?
I would say that helmet with the horns coming out.
Right. It looks like the Minnesota Vikings helmet, right?
Exactly.
Well, that was borrowed from Africans. I have a picture that is in the collage of a fellow by the name of it was on a rock, carved into a rock. It's a picture of a fellow, the king of Akkad, the son of Sargon, and his name is Nyram Sin, and he is pictured in that stone age going back to 2254 BCE. So 3,254 years before there were any Vikings in America, they were wearing those helmets, and it's the exact same shape the helmet is and the two horns coming out. A picture that I did not send you because I couldn't send you all of my pictures. I have a 150 slide presentation that goes for 2 hours, or I have a all-day seminar which goes for 8 hours. And in that we see a picture of a so-called Viking sled. But it wasn't a Viking sled, because this sled goes back before there were any white Vikings in Scandinavia. These sleds were made by the indigenous people to Europe, which were the Kwa and the Ainu. And in that sled, the top part, well, the bottom part was, of course, iron. The runners were iron, and the sled was made out of wood, and they carved a signature of who made it and who made this sled. And the signature wasn't a was not words or letters; it was pictures, and it had pictures of these short Africans, very short Africans, and they had they had faces like and skulls like Africans, diacephalic skull, which is a long skull, and their jaws stuck out. In many Caucasian people, many of them, I'd say most, if you put your hand up to your nose and you have it vertically and you put it towards your nose, your nose touches your hand, but your lips and your chin do not. In most African people, if you put your hand out like that and come towards your nose and your lips touch. That's called prognathism. That's a well-known trait in African people of African descent. And this is what they look like. And there are two fellows who are facing a woman on a horse. And the woman on the horse has extreme prognathism and some very projecting lips. Now, on her head, she's wearing cornrows that are pulled back into a bun, just like African women and American women, black women wear today. And the two fellows had cornrows going to the sides of their head. So we see that they're short. Had cornrows. They had the first sleds that were there thousands of years before the Vikings get to Scandinavia from the Russian steppes, and also they had the prognathism and the diacephalic heads. So I think that's enough evidence to show that they were the first Vikings. So this is the story of the say the Black Vikings, the first Vikings.
Okay, I'm gonna bring Elise back on. Okay, Elise, did you have any other questions regarding that?
Well, yes, I'm interested in what the role of the women in the culture was. If we have a picture of a woman on a horse, what does that mean for the women's status in their culture?
Well, that would mean, I would say, just right off the bat, is the two fellows were gentlemen. but if you go back to these cultures, all of these African cultures were matriarchal. Okay, they were not paternal; they were matriarchal. Most of the Caucasian cultures had a patriarchal society, and they had. There are a lot of these old statues going back to 30,000 years ago that are found in Europe of obese black women standing and sitting, and they were called the mother goddess. So mother goddesses there were first before any father gods. And the women continue to be important in the African societies, even into Egypt. Ah, did you know that we had several female pharaohs? One of the most famous ones was Hatshepsut. So there were several female black pharaohs, and there was no sexism in these ancient Egyptian cultures.
This seems to be a very humane culture in terms of the way that it's set up. And so I can see how difficult it might be for us raised in the Western mindset to be able to receive this as a part of our genetic and cultural history. Do you have any suggestions as to how we might be able to utilize this information in our culture today? How we can introduce it, how we can best utilize it?
I would say the best way to introduce it is to form book clubs. And these are grown-ups who are form book clubs, and they read a book a month or something like that. And there are a few out there now. If you want to start a book club, you can get in touch with the people at ASCAC. ASCAC is an acronym for a black group called the Association for the Study of Ancient African Culture, or something of that nature, ASCAC. Study of Classical African History, that's it, ASCAC. The way that they do is if you want to start a ASCAC book club in your region, you call ASCAC, and you can look them up in the Google, and they will give you a outline on how to start a group, how to run a group, and what books you should read. Now, that's the interim level, so that the grown-ups start learning about their ancient phenomenal culture. As a matter of fact, I'll mention this later, that they were part of the ancient African antediluvian megalithic worldwide maritime civilization, and I'll go into that later when it's appropriate.
Yes,
but
you will have to.
but once you get the basics down, then you start teaching your children, and then once you because you see when you read something, you learn it, but when you teach it, you master it. Once you start teaching it to your children and you master it, then it's time to start getting into the schools. Some people say you ought to get into the schools first. I would say no. Learn your information first before you start taking books out and teaching people. But there are several PhDs in African American history who dabble into ancient African history, and that is the way to that I would think that we should approach. Getting to the homeschool black children and white children, anyone who wants to learn about this culture, because it is their culture too. If you go back far enough, because they're saying now that DNA shows that everyone came from Africa. Then after you go to the homeschool people, you go to the charter schools, and from the charter schools, you'll have your curriculum, everything straight. So by the time you reach the public schools and start demanding that this be taught in public schools, then it will be smooth sailing. All the kinks will be out. I think that's a nice way to start.
Thank you very much. Yes, we're familiar with ASCAC, and had not thought about them for quite some time. So it's time to return to some of this information that we've been exposed to over the years. Thank you very kindly, and I will be listening for the rest of your interview to hear the definition of the people that you say sailed around the world and that were the only people that were on the earth.
Yes. And you might want to go to my website. It is historic, HISTORIC, historictruth.info. That's HISTORIC, truth, TRUTH. That's one word. historictruth.info, and you'll see a plethora of information and videos and radio shows. Thank you.
And is that how we can get your current book?
Yes, you can get it through there as well as my T-shirts and my some of the tapes that I have available, the DVDs.
Thank you very much.
Thank you so much for calling. Okay, so Walter, we have covered just a few things. If you want to hear about what I just spoke of, the ancient African antediluvian megalithic worldwide maritime civilization. Okay, what that means is ancient Africans. Antediluvian means before the flood. Ancient Africans before the flood were traveling the world. And they're traveling the world by boat, so that's maritime. And when they got there, they put together civilizations, and they built their some of their temples and pyramids with megalithic blocks, those are gigantic blocks. So In other words, it was an ancient African antediluvial megalithic worldwide maritime civilization. And it was called Zeptepi. Zeptepi means the first time. So that was the world, that was the civilization that was wiped out by the flood.
Zeptepi.
Yeah, Z-E-P, Z as in zebra, Z-E-P-T-E-P-I, T as in Tom, E-P-I. And you're going to be hard to find that information, very hard, because that is totally buried. You think the information about the Skraelings and the short Africans in America was buried, then good luck trying to find this about Zeptepi. Hey, where you can, there's a book about 3 or 4 inches thick, written by my friend Graham Hancock, who was one of the people who did the introduction to my book, I would say endorsements to my book. He wrote a book called Underworld, and in that book, it's a beautifully illustrated book, and it's about 3 inches thick, and it has pictures of all these underwater artifacts and some underwater structures all over the planet. So that was part of Zeptepi before the flood, before it was flooded.
So this information is in the public domain. We can find it.
Oh, yes. Oh, yes, you can. There for those who want to dig, but trust me, they did not teach this in school.
And the author of the book, The Underworld, is Graham Hancock?
You bet, that's right. No D, it's H-A-N.
Thank you.
C-O-C-K, Hancock.
Thank you very much. There are people out there who are interested in this kind of scholarly endeavor, and so it's very refreshing and very enlightening to be able to have access to it in these times.
Thank you very much. That is my passion, to get that out to you. And thank you so much for calling.
It's my pleasure, and I will continue to listen to the interview. Walter, I know you're there.
Okay, Dr. Imhotep, why don't I just let you go through your controversial items list at your leisure, and I'll just comment if you wish. And that way I can just, we can keep this on track.
Okay, that's fine. And any callers we get, we would just stop and take the call. Yes.
Sure. If anybody has any questions, just go ahead and, break in and ask questions.
Okay. Let's see. Next would be, and these are all controversial, but they're backed by my documented evidence. So the first Asians, I'll back up. The first Americans documented, the Africans to come here, were between 56 and 60,000 years ago. And they come over and they are here for a while, and then later on they start building civilizations. And they started building temples and pyramids in all three Americas, North America, Central America, and South America. The most well-known pyramids in America were dirt pyramids, and some of the pyramids were as large as some of the pyramids in Egypt. And there are one or two of them that are still available for us to see, and that is the remains of Cahokia. Cahokia is in about a half an hour from St. Louis, Missouri. And Cahokia is a gigantic dirt earthen mound that is still there today. I was there. I spoke in St. Louis, I think, two months ago, and went out there to see that so-called Indian mound. Not an Indian mound, but of course the Africans built that pyramid. And those things were found all over the Americas. So you'll see they were there for 56 to 60,000 years, and then it wasn't, they, people say, well, where are the Asians at that time? They are, first of all, they didn't exist way back then. When they finally are, when they finally do become in existence, there's no record of them, no artifacts. This is another dissertation I found. Their first artifacts are found approximately 3,000 BCE in Australia. I'm sorry, in Alaska. And those are the first bones and whatnot of people who look Asian. Now, the American Indians, if they were the first people here, then they should look like the Chinese who we are told came over. But people out there in America, look in your minds about what you've seen on television, what you are told about what the Native Americans look like. They're tall. They're not real tall, but they're tall enough, five to 6.5 feet tall. They're slender. They have allocephalic heads, kind of long heads, and they have long hair, and they have slightly larger noses than regular people in some cases. And they have a reddish tone to their yellowish type skin. So this does not sound like someone who is from Asia, an Asian. You know, the Asians are a little shorter. They have a shorter trunk, shorter arms, and their heads are round, usually, and they have a flat type face. So this is different looking than the American Indians, and also they have the epicanthal fold, their eyes, which makes their eyes slanted. So you say, well, they don't exactly look like the Indians do not exactly look like the Chinese. Now, if they were indeed the first Americans and the only Americans to come here before until the Caucasians come, then why is it that they look so different? That is obvious, because they were not just the Chinese. These Chinese, or specifically the Mongolians, who were the first Asians to come over around 3000 BC after the icebergs melt between Alaska and Asia. So when they do come over, they fight, of course, over land or whatnot, and sometimes they have treaties, sometimes they get along, and other times they make babies. And it is their babies, between the Africans who had been there for 53,000 years before these Asians come over in 3000 BC, it is their babies that become the first Americans. And this is seen all over the Americas. You see that there were no Asian skulls with the brachiocephalic round heads and flat faces. There were none of those till after 3000 BC when these people come over. But there is a mass grave site, I'm told, of these short Africans in somewhere in Tennessee, where there was a mass grave site because they used to kill these people unbelievably, just like they did the Native Americans. Let's see, the next thing, I don't want to keep going on and on like that. I want to stay on task here. The next thing we see here is Abu Bakari. Abu Bakari, yes. Abu Bakari, you know, most African Americans, where I grew up, we were told that the first Africans that came over here were brought over by the Caucasians as slaves. And that's insane, because you have Abu Bakari, who is known to have come to the Americas 1312 A.D. Abu Bakari II came over with 2,000 wooden ships, and he reached the Americas as early as 1312 A.D. And those were from Mali. Those Africans were from Mali. 2,000 ships. And we're told in history, we don't know where they went. They just went over, they got into the boats and went somewhere, and we have no idea where they went. That is not true. The Africans know exactly where they went, because they left when they got to some big rivers in South America, which is where they landed, South America. they had these big rocks, these big slabs, notes to other people who would come over from Africa, and they in their language, the Mande, I believe it was the Mande language or Manding language, and they would write on those big slabs, going down this river, there are friendly natives or there are unfriendly natives. So we know exactly where they landed. So then we come to 1607, Captain John Smith. We know Captain John Smith created the first colony in Virginia, and Captain John Smith had some problems with the black Indians there, and they fought a little bit, and they captured him and held him hostage for a while. And after a while, they let him go, and he was complaining about his the chief's men. He says they were as black as the chief was. So that's kind of straightforward to what those people look like. So all Indians, we were taught who also that the. That there were black Indians, but they were all 100% ex-runaway slaves who ran away to join the Indians in the swamps in Florida, Georgia, and Alabama, and places of that nature. Well, this will show that that is absolutely ridiculous. There is too much information, like I'm putting out there, to show that there were black Indians, there were black natives here. The original people were Africans, and much later have the Asians coming over to Americas, and then they mix their blood.
In summary, what I'm hearing you say is that, you know, more than 20,000 years ago, the first people to come to that were in America were of African origin, and that they mixed with Asian people, which basically resulted in what we call the Native American races, the Choctaw, the Cherokee, the Aztec, the Inca, the Mohican. Is that correct?
That is correct, sir. At least 56,000 years ago, the Africans come over, and then not until 3,000 B.C., The Asians come over, and they when they mix their blood, the result, their babies are the first Native Americans, as they call them. The first original Americans are the Africans, but their children are the so-called Indians of today.
I see. Well, that's really startling, you know, compared to what we have been taught. You know, throughout our history. But what you're saying seems to make sense. I mean, because, as you mentioned, the people that we call Native Americans are much darker than Asians. So how did that transpire? And there are many other links, such as the pyramids and the type of boats that the Africans use. So I'll turn it back over to you to continue on with your explanation of these controversial items in your book.
Okay. The next one, you know, people are talking about the Indian mounds. Indian mounds, they're so incredible. They're ancient, they're this, that, and the other. Well, there's a fellow, some people at the Smithsonian that do not believe that there are any such things called Indian mounds. And that is in 1881, John W. Powell, a high official in the Smithsonian Institute, appointed Cyrus Thomas, and this is a quote, Cyrus Thomas to be director of the Eastern Mound Division of the Smithsonian Institute's Bureau of Ethnology. Now, Cyrus Thomas commented on Indian mounds in America, and he said, and I quote here, he quoted as saying, there was a race of mound builders in America distinct from the American Indians. Now, are there any mounds in Africa? Yes. There are mounds in different places in Africa, all over Africa. There's some in Mauritania. Okay, you come right up to the top left northwestern point of Africa. And Mauritania and Algeria, there are mounds. And there are there are mounds right now today that you can see also in the Niger River. All up and down the Niger River, there are mounds. But we know that the Africans have been building mounds since the beginning. The quote that distinct from the American Indians means they were not American Indians is that there was a race of mound builders in America distinct from the American Indians. And this is Cyrus Thomas, who was appointed by John W. Powell to be the director of the Eastern Mound Division, Smithsonian Institute Bureau of Ethnology. And in my book, I show a picture of these different mounds that Cyrus Thomas went all over America for years and dated and showed that they did exist, and he studied them, and he made a beautiful map. And at that time, he said there must have been at least 100,000 Indian mounds in Americas at that time, 100,000. And only today, only about 100,000 remain. When people say 100,000, most people have never seen an Indian mound. That's because they were bulldozed and that nature, or they're in the hills now today in lands where that are covered with forest, and there are still some forests in Eastern America. And most of these mounds, almost all of them, are in eastern U.S. from end at the Mississippi River. Now this is really something. Other quote I remember, and they said before Columbus came, there were many trees. There was a gigantic forest in continental United States in northern North America, and for example, a squirrel could get into a tree in say in Long Island, and he could jump from tree to tree and would never have to reach the ground until he got to Mississippi River. What do you think about that, Walter?
Well, I know that there were accounts from sailors indicating they could smell the trees and the evergreen trees, et cetera, many days out at sea.
Mm-hmm. There you go.
And the other part of this is there is a monument in Alabama. It's called Moundville, where the Indian mounds exist.
Okay.
It's actually a park. I don't know if it's a national park or state park. But there is a location in Alabama called Moundville to confirm what you just said about the mounds.
And there, on the exit in on I think it was Highway 10 or Highway 55 in Louisiana or Mississippi, it is, and it's just called Mound. It's called Mound. The city's name Mound. It's a small town, I guess. Mound. I didn't have time to go investigate, but next time I'm down there, I surely will. Okay, let's see what else. The Central America has pyramids as wide as the Egyptian pyramids. For example, the base of the Pyramid of the Sun. Most people know of the pyramid, the gigantic pyramid complex in Mexico is about 90 miles northwest of Mexico City. You have the Pyramid of the Sun, Pyramid of the Moon, but the Pyramid of the Sun has a base almost identical to that of the Pyramid of Giza. It's gigantic. However, it is a step pyramid. Now, almost all of the stone pyramids that they found in Central America and South America, by the way, there are many of them, in La Venta, in the La Venta jungle, which is in Mexico, Central America, in the jungle, they have found over 400 temples alone, just in the La Venta jungle. So these structures are numerous all over Central America because they didn't tear them down as has happened in North America. And also South America has a plethora of temples and pyramids. But all of these pyramids are the step pyramid type pyramid, which means to me, now I have no proof of this, I have no idea about this except for I haven't read this anywhere, but my idea is about why there are all step pyramids over in Egypt. How much time do we have, Walter?
Oh, you still got an hour and 5 minutes.
Okay, because I'm about half through. the oldest pyramid in the world that we know of, people know of, it's in Saqqara, Egypt, which is southern Egypt, and it is a step pyramid. So they built step pyramids there for a while until they evolved to the smooth-sided pyramids. These people were all making the step pyramids. So to me, why would they be making step pyramids when the smooth-sided pyramids were more beautiful? They were just a work of art. And they predate the, they come after the step pyramids. Well, to me, I would think that some of the people who built those step pyramids left Egypt en masse before they started making the smooth side pyramids. Now, people say, well, the Olmecs, we've heard that the Olmecs was the mother culture of the Americas. Well, they were before they came here before the Aztecs developed and those type of Indians, of course. But, however, they were not the first civilization here, and they talk about the Olmecs being here around 2100 BC or 2400 BC. That is, that's kind of hard to believe because these people are the ones who built the step pyramids in Central America and Mexico. Well, also, there's another example. See how old they are, how old the Olmec civilization is. They built these, the Olmecs supposedly built these first step pyramids there all over Mexico and the Yucatan Peninsula. Well, you can Google this, see if I'm telling the truth. You can Google Cuba Underwater City. Ever heard of the Underwater City right outside of Cuba? Walter?
I have not.
Okay. Anyone can Google this, Cuba Underwater City, and you will see a complete city 3.5 miles southwest of Cuba. It seems like if it fell and went down, then it fell without one brick coming out of one of those temples or anything, because the whole city is still there. You see houses, you see roads, you see bridges, you see temples, and you see pyramids, plural. But guess what type of pyramids they are? They are the step pyramids. So obviously this city was built before the flood, which means it was part of Zeb Tepe, that civilization. And the flood happens 13,000 years ago. So this city had to have been erected 1,000 years ago or more. And my point is that if they had step pyramids that close to Mexico, which is Yucatan Peninsula and Cuba, that is the area inside between those two places where this city is, between the Yucatan Peninsula and Cuba, are closer to Cuba than the Yucatan, but it's right in the middle, and then you have in the Yucatan, you have all of these pyramids that are built just like the ones under the water. So it would seem that the evidence shows that was, once all of that area was out of the water, you know, during the Ice Age, because during the Ice Age, the oceans were between 100 to 200 feet more shallow because the North Pole had shifted over top of Canada, polar shift, and the flood. When you have a polar shift, the planet shifts to a few degrees to the right or to the left, and sometimes it's as far as from the North Pole to Canada. And there's evidence of that happening. And when that happens, where it was very, very cold in the North Pole. When it shifted over, it shifted over to somewhere that was warmer. And then the place that's warmer, it shifted into the place where the North Pole is, and it becomes cold. So it's equal to someone putting a glass of water on a table, and it has ice cubes in it. Just follow me. The water in the glass represents the oceans. The ice cube represent the North Pole. Now, understand that the South Pole, the ice is sitting on top of a landmass called Antarctica. Okay, but up at the North Pole, there is no landmass underneath the North Pole. It's a gigantic slab of ice, gigantic iceberg. Trillions and trillions and trillions and zillions of tons of ice. Okay, now when that area changes, and you know, as a matter of fact, I want to interject something here. They say that they don't know where ice ages come from or where they go. And that is absolutely ludicrous. They know exactly where they come from and where they go. And I can tell you that when I say this, you're going to go, oh, my goodness, that's right. Anyone who's ever heard that will say that. There is a continuous ice age on this planet, and there is one still. Where is it? At the North Pole and the South Pole. When these things flip, and it becomes warmer where it was colder and colder was warmer, the people would automatically say, oh, it's an ice age here. Well, it might be an ice age there, but where the planet flipped from, where it was very cold, it became warm. Now, how is this possible? Well, it's very simple. If you took elementary geography, if you look at the planet and you look at the North Pole and South Pole, they are not receiving direct rays from the sun. The most direct rays from the sun go straight to the equator. That's why it's the warmest part of the globe. They hit perpendicular up to the North Pole or South Pole. They're glancing off, so there's very little sunlight there compared to the equator. And as a matter of fact, sometimes in the North Pole, in the South Pole, some parts of the year there's 6 months of darkness. So of course it's going to be colder there. So my point is that if you have that glass of water now, and you take the ice cube out of the glass of water and you put it down on the table, then what level will the water be? Will the water go up or go down? Of course it will go down. So during the ice age, you have a tremendous flood in the beginning where all that water floods, and of course we know in the Bible and in other places. Every culture in the world has a story about the flood. It flooded, but then after it flooded, all of this snow and ice that develops at the north, at the new North and South Pole, okay, are over top of land, not over top of the water. Therefore, when after it floods, slowly the water goes down because all of this rain that has turned into snow and ice continues to hit places that are on the earth and have the earth to fall on, which do not push down their weight onto the water, make the water rise. So slowly the oceans began to go down. Now, when that happens, these oceans go down. If this was 150 or so thousand years it lasted, that's a long period of time. So these places like Zeptepi, the people who are coming out of Africa, going to different parts of the planet, let's just say you went to New York, and you started living on the beach in New York. Well, let's say the water receded and went back, you know, 10 or 20 miles. All right, this ocean bottom starts to be exposed, and in order to get to the place, the end of that, the beach, the new beach that would be exposed, you would have to go travel to where you saw water again. Now all of that is old muck and very rich, probably the richest soil next to a volcanic soil that there is. So they could grow incredible things there, number one, and number two, they'll be closer to the water. Now back then there were no planes, trains, or cars, so they traveled exclusively long distances by boat. Okay. So it would make sense that they would make their new cities closer to the coasts. So this is what they did. They made their new cities closer to the coast for thousands of years. Then when the planet flips over again back to in the position where it is now, and it goes back to having the North Pole up where there is water, and all of this ice starts to create there and push down on that, and the water level starts to go up, these places are flooded. And that's where that second flood comes from, the ones that we know about. And it destroys most of Zeptepi.
Okay.
So that's a long story.
One second. We have another caller from a 314 area code. Can you identify yourself, please?
Yes, Bianca calling from the Midwest.
Who is this?
This is Pianchi calling from the Midwest. How you doing?
We're doing good.
Well, Pianchi.
Yeah, you're not saying that these flood stories in the Bible are surreal, are you?
I'm not saying anything about the Bible because I do not discuss religion or politics.
Well, I'm not talking about the religion. I'm talking about the stories.
Well, I don't know about
because
the story. All I'm saying is scientifically what happened.
Well, I believe in, you know, pole shifts wouldn't cause any difference in the fact that you have polar caps. Polar caps are caused because the sun on a track up about 22.5 degrees, either north latitude or south latitude. And like you said before, you just don't get no sun there. The greatest force in the universe is cold. And without a sun, this cold will dominate. You know, this Earth was at one time one big snow cone until things began to melt and settle the way they are. But the thing that I was going to say is that these people talk about these flood stories where all the world was covered in water. That's just totally not possible. Because if you look at the mountaintops, for instance, like Mount Kilimanjaro. Mount Kilimanjaro is like 30,000 feet above sea level. At 35 feet above sea level, the temperature is about 30 degrees below zero. If you ever flew on jet planes and get up at those cruising altitudes and where they show the outside temperature, it tells you that the outside temperature is that cold. So that dispels, you know, that rumor. Then another thing, that group of people that was found that reside there on the Andaman Islands right off the southern tip of India who have DNA genes that date back over 65,000 years ago, they don't recall of none of these stories or these events that, you know, people like to proclaim. The Jarawa, by the way, is what their name are.
Well, thank you. Thank you very much for your comment.
Yeah, these cities that you're talking about off of Cuba, they deserve, it could have been an island that sunk. Islands rise and sink all the time because of volcanic activity and the amount of molten rock that those areas are sitting on. You know, one other thing, you talk about Zeptepi. Africans build things according to their genetic memory bank. There at Mount Kilimanjaro, when that volcano was erupting and causing people to panic and move, that's still in their memory bank. That's why come they build pyramids. Erupting volcanoes is the shape of a pyramid. You look at your cities in Western Hemisphere, they built like icicles, long, tall, structures going up and down at different heights. If you stand back off of on the horizon, look at them, and if they all was painted white, they would look like icicles. So those what's in those people's memory banks. And you know, one other thing too, what we call today the Mediterranean Sea, now there is a lot of credence that that was at one time dry, and right there where at Gibraltar, what they call the Pillars of Hercules, that was landlocked, cutting it off from what's now called the Atlantic Ocean. And when that broke through, those areas, that could be the flood that people are talking about and associate with Bible stories.
Well, thank you very much for your comments.
It would be interesting if people would further, you know, do take the time and go discover. They've got the equipment, the technology, where they can go down 2,000 feet and examine these structures and see, get a better realization exactly what's going on.
Okay, well.
And you know, you talk about the pyramids there on the Giza plateau. You know, I spent 8 years in Egypt from Cairo to the northern Sudan border going in and out of pyramids, temples, and tombs. And you, right there next to the Red Pyramid, Seneferu's Pyramid, is the Bent Pyramid, where you can see that when they was building that, they was going at the wrong angle. They tried to correct it, then they abandoned the project entirely. It's still standing there today. So, anyway, I just wanted to contribute that.
That was a great contribution. Thank you very much for calling, Pianchi.
Sure.
Okay.
And Elise, you're online. Do you have any questions? Elise? Okay. Okay, well, go ahead, Dr. Imhotep.
Okay, the next thing I wanted to cover was that these so-called mound builders, if you looked at this map that I have in the book that Cyrus Thomas charted, you can see the majority of mounds follow the great rivers in the Americas, the Mississippi, the Ohio River, and the rivers in the mostly the rivers in the east, but also some of them in the Missouri River. And along, it's really a phenomenon in along the Ohio River. They found 20 or 30 or so of these mounds, one after another. And inside the mounds, there were iron smelters. They were smelting iron, and this is before Columbus, far before Columbus. They were smelting iron. They found things such as shovels, axes, and iron implements. And they took them to I mentioned the scientists that they took them to in my book, and they found that they were extremely old. So in some of these mounds, they were smelting iron, and these were the short Trois and Anu. Well, these people were doing the same thing many, many years ago. In Africa, they found a ancient African iron mine where they were mining iron back dating 4,200 years BC. And these iron smelters were also smelting arrowheads. So they found some iron type arrowheads that were left over. And most of these things were in very bad shape because you know that iron slowly decomposes. But for what they saw, there must have been a very high grade iron because they found these shovels and spear tips and whatever. And that was several mounds along the Ohio River. Next, we go to another type of metal that they were mining, and that is copper. In Lake Michigan, there's an island called Isle Royale. I show a map of North America, and they were mining millions, and now it's been upgraded to at least a billion tons of copper were mined from Isle Royale on Lake Michigan and taken out. And now people say, well, where did it go? Because there are in the mounds and different places in the Americas, they don't see any evidence of things being made from a billion tons of copper being mined. Well, there are some theories and stories about how that they were taking that copper out and taking it over into the Mediterranean to Africa itself, and they were making tin out of it. So that's one of the things that you use to make tin. The date for these old abandoned copper mines in Michigan, there was a TV program on Ancient America where they showed some of these mines where they'd taken out so much copper. Their holes in the big gigantic caverns in that island are at least 5,000 BC. So they were taking this out of there. Now, how do they take it out? Do they take it out overland? That's kind of impossible, a billion tons. It seems that they took it out by boat. Now, they take it out by canoe. That's another problem. There have been about a trillion canoes. But there was a show on History Channel. It what was called the mega ships that they used to have way back to show some for Rome and Greece, and then they went back even to Egypt. Okay, the Egyptians had mega ships, gigantic ships. Okay, there is a picture of one. This is not just conjecture. There's a picture of one that is carved into the female pharaoh Hatshepsut's funerary temple, and I took a picture of it. And there is a gigantic megaship. It has a picture of a regular-sized ship right in front of it, and you can see it dwarfs that ship. And then its cargo on top of this megaship. Now, this is just on top, were two gigantic tekenus, which we call obelisks now. They're shaped exactly like the Washington Monument. But each one of them weighed 750 tons. That's 1,500 tons it displaced. And that was just on top. So this had to be a gigantic ship. They knew how to build big ships, so that must have been one of the ships that they carried out this billion tons of copper with. So we're talking about international trade here. Well, international trade, was that going on? There is a gigantic, I have my last three chapters are dealing with this because it's the biggest piece of evidence that the Egyptians and people of the Nile Valley, and not discluding any other people from Africa, but the evidence from Nile Valley is there. There's a place called the Bimini Road, the Indians called it in the Bahamas. And they showed Spanish and probably French, but definitely the Spanish, they showed it. They said there's a road underneath the water. And in 20 feet of water, 20 feet deep, a little less than a mile off of the western coast of Bimini, you can go out there. It's 20 feet deep, and you can look down the water, and you can see a 600-yard-long structure. And it looks like a road because it's 600 yards long, and it's about 20 yards wide, 20, 30 yards wide. And they call that a road, so they call it the Bimini Road. Well, since then, there were some people who have gone down, a couple doctors, PhDs, have gone and studied that with snorkeling and took pictures of them. And I have some of the pictures in my in my day-long seminar and two-hour seminar. And it shows that this was a breakwater. Okay? A breakwater for what? It was a gigantic island there. And it was also right behind that breakwater, about another 50 yards away, there was a pier with gigantic blocks identical to the ones on the this breakwater. It looks like it was a pier, and that was part of the gigantic island that was exposed during the Ice Age. It was exposed probably for 100,000 years. If we look at a map of the ocean currents, we'll see that there are rivers in the ocean. The currents, they run like conveyor belts. The evidence of that is that we've always heard that you can throw a bottle into the ocean, and with a note inside of it, and seal it up, and it will go from Africa to England or northern Europe, and then go down the coast to Africa, and then go from Africa straight over to the Bahamas. I mean straight to the Bahamas. So they obviously used this route from Africa to the Bahamas, and they built this gigantic pier, and even farther, a more gigantic breakwater, for a reason. Now, if you're just bringing over goods from the Americas, which is only 55 miles from the Bahamas, water-wise, 55 nautical miles, you'll see that if you had just small little canoes, why would you need a gigantic pier to unload them on? You just put it up on the beach. And then further, why would you need to have a breakwater that breaks the waves over? Well, this is because when they brought the ships over and to unload at the pier, gigantic ships, the ships would be going up and down with the ebb and flow of the waves. So these breakwaters did just that. They broke the waves. And it was calm there where the ship could be steady, taken off. Now, the evidence of that is that in the Aztec Indians, when Cortez, the Spanish inquisitor, when he first came to the Aztec Indians and went up there before they had a fight, when they had a meeting and see Montezuma, they have pictures of this. Montezuma is standing up on top of one of his temples, the pyramids, and he is wearing an African lion skin. And there are no African lions in Central, North, or South America. They have panthers and pumas and mountain lions, of course, but they're nothing like the gigantic head and tail and whatnot of the African lion. So he was wearing an African lion skin that is obviously from Africa. Now then, if you go all the way over across the ocean, and we're not talking about Western Africa, we're talking about in the Nile Valley, in Ramses' tomb, Ramses II, and they did a scan of his body and whatnot. Then they went to his stomach and looked inside his stomach, and guess what was there? American tobacco, okay, and also South American cocaine leaves, residents from cocaine leaves. This man would live to be 94, so he must have ingested that at soon before his death, a few minutes or a few hours or so before his death, because they hadn't been totally digested. Why would he be eating cocaine leaves, coca leaves? They looked at his teeth, and he had problems with his teeth, so it looked like they were trying to numb his teeth or his gums or whatnot with the cocaine leaves so they could work on his teeth. But the point here is that these coca leaves at that time period were only found in South America. So those two things, Brazilian coca leaves and American tobacco, was found in this. So that shows that they were going back and forth. And in my book, I show many different items that they brought here from Africa and some things that they took back with them during the international trade that was going on. We'll see the language. There's some tribes who used, they found Egyptian hieroglyphs in their writings, and yes, some tribes did write, of course they wrote. They were black Indians. There's a Mi'kmaq tribe who used so many of those Egyptian medunetcher or hieroglyphs. Some of the words were identical, not similar, but identical to these Egyptian symbols and whatnot. So they were writing with the Egyptian Medu. And if we look out around the large 600-yard-long breakwater in right off of Bimini, I forgot to tell you that they found some things in the water, too. They found some Egyptian anchors. They found some columns. And they also found some artifacts, one of which looked like an obelisk standing straight up in the water still. And then if you go out 90, let me see, I think they said 9 miles or so out, they found, that was 9 miles west, even further west into the deep, 90 feet deep, I'm sorry, 90 feet deep in that water. They found some structures that were buildings. They were knocked down, but their bases were there. And they carbon dated those to 21,520 years old. And this was a TV special that these people put on in the History Channel. So we're talking about structures that were out of the water at one time when the water level around the planet was far more shallow. And they found that these structures, unless they built these structures underwater, then they were built during a time where the water was down. And that's this land over there where the brother was talking about the Andaman Islands. Andaman Islands were part of possibly part of the gigantic island that was up at that time. Some people call it Lemuria. Okay, if you have a gigantic island also in the right off of Florida, Cuba, the Bahamas were not possibly, that was one of the Atlantises, but there were many Atlantises. There were many places that were exposed to the water that were not exposed now, and you can see that in Graham Hancock's book, and he takes pictures of them. Partial pieces of buildings, some roofs from buildings, different things, all over the planet, not just in the Sudaland area where, talking about Guam and the Philippines, whatnot, were actually mountain tops at that time. Talking about other different places in Mediterranean were also. They found parts of a city off right off the Nile Valley. They found statues and whatnot. So the Nile Delta was far shallower as well. And like the brother accurately said, there was a time when the within most or possibly all of the Mediterranean was a big valley, but definitely, and that's not definite, but definitely France, Spain, and Mauritania were connected. This is how the first Europeans, the Anu and Trois, went up 45,000 years ago up into Europe. They walked along that path and created those drawings. We know the African animals that we see on in the caves and the rocks. One of my most favorite parts that I found was that they're always talking about the Indians, Native Americans were all hunter gatherers and they didn't farm. They just ran all over the place and shot buffalo and ate the deer meat and whatnot, and they didn't farm. Well, if they didn't farm, I ask you, Walter, does it make sense? If they didn't farm, and where did they get the food from, the corn and other different things that they brought to the pilgrims who were starving during their first winter in America? How does that sound, Walter?
Well, it doesn't sound true. I mean, because they showed them how to put fish in the ground and then plant corn on top of it. So
there
they obviously
go.
Had very advanced farming technique.
There you go. Every corn stalk had the head of a fish. They would dig a hole, they put the head of a fish in, and they would buy, and fish is a phenomenal fertilizer. So, of course, they were not just farming, they were master farmers, because these people were Africans who came from, who, if they were able to come all the way across the ocean, I mean, they were from an advanced society, and they brought some of the advanced things there with them. And here are some of the things that they have found that we will not see on any of these channels, right? They found a network of canals, a network of roads, and of course they were writing, as I showed you in the Medu Nature. They found mathematic evidence seen in their astronomy, their advanced astronomy, and their advanced astronomy was the way they situated some of these pyramids to magnetic north and magnetic south, and some of the ways that they pointed their pyramids. You had to have mathematics and advanced astronomy to do that. They were making cotton because they brought over strands of cotton that were not known in the Americas. And the man who I give all praises to, or Ivan Van Zertima, whose shoulders I stand on, the top of his shoulders, because he wrote the book They Came Before Columbus. That's the Indians, the Africans came before Columbus. Well, my book just shows a little bit more. But there's more evidence since he died 33 years ago. He wrote that book, a lot more evidence out, in which I show not only did we come here, did the Africans come here before Columbus, they came before the Indians, and they made the Indians. Okay, so they made cotton clothes out of it. There are a lot of pictures of, there are a few pictures of Indians wearing cotton clothes. Olmecs means rubber, so Olmecs. Their basis, their name was rubber. They brought rubber trees with them from Africa, and they were making rubber things. One of the major things we know that they were making, they were making rubber balls, because they found some of the games that the Aztecs and the Toltecs and these other ancient Olmecs were playing were with rubber balls. They repaired skeletons that had teeth with metal caps on them, so it looks like they were repairing teeth like modern bridge work. And some of the buildings that they made were phenomenally large. They didn't all just live in teepees like we were shown. That is just amazingly wrong. You wouldn't wear cotton clothes way up in North Dakota in the in the north. But you also wouldn't wear these big deerskin garments that we see the Indians wear on the so-called Indians wearing on the cowboy pictures. You wouldn't wear that down in Texas and in Florida, and especially not down in Central America. And of course, they farm exclusively. There's a part in my book where I showed a cavalry come in to kill the people who from a village that I guess that they were coming in and raiding and killing whites, I guess. But they came in, and before they killed all these people, they saw yards and gigantic groves of fruit trees and wheat and all these different things growing that were obviously there for a long time, and they burned the village as well as their crops and their trees and whatnot. But they go into a very big discussion and talking about exactly what it looked like, and it was written down by the cavalry officer, and I quoted that in my book as well. As far as the canals were irrigation canals, and they probably doubled as the area canal to pull heavy loads with and to use as an ancient highway, like they used the rivers, the Mississippi River and Ohio River, like I-95 and Route 66. So these canals they used for transportation as well as a road system that they had. And these things can be found in the Southwest. They're still there. The people close by know, but they're not talking about them, like evidently on the radios. And, well, now they are on radio, thanks to Walter. So the canals were amazingly, they were narrow, not wide, because that would lead to more evaporation. So they were narrow and deep. And the bottoms, this is amazing, the bottoms was made with asphalt. Now, this is crazy, but people were not going to believe this, but they saw that the bottom, some of the residue there, was asphalt. Now, this isn't too far out, because over in Egypt, in some of the tombs, they found these ancient batteries, and the bottoms of the batteries were coated in asphalt as well. So we know that asphalt goes back thousands and thousands of years. So obviously they just brought over here, and they made the bottoms of these canals with asphalt so they wouldn't lose water from the bottom. So they had the technology not to lose water draining into the earth from the bottom, and then from the top they were more narrow, so there would not be as much surface area for the water to evaporate. But that is not the biggest thing that amazed me. On the side of one of these canals, they had these series of posts. On the posts, they had, I think it was volcanic glass. Now, they said, what in the world are these made for? Well, one white fellow figured out what they were doing with it. This is amazing, Walter. This is amazing. You know that, Walter, you do know that the Indians had smoke signals, which means they had a code so they could send messages. Right, Walter?
Exactly.
Okay. Well, if they had a code where they could send messages by smoke signal, check what they were doing with this. They would line up the tops of the posts with the volcanic rock that was like glass. And during the day or night, they could send signals. Now, at nighttime, they would send signals by putting a mirror-type piece reflecting the a fire. They would have a fire, and they would reflect the fire into a post. And each one of the lights would go from post to post to post. And in the day, it would do it with using the sun. Well, how fast do you think this message would get to the other end?
It was basically light. The speed of light.
The speed of light. Can you imagine that? That it would go as faster than our modern telegraphs or electricity. Why? Because there is no wires for resistance. So it was a faster communication by wire that we have even today. This is amazing. These are some of the amazing things that we just don't hear about. And these are documented in the books. And I give all my sources in all of these books to show people where it was from, and they can do their research to see that some of these things you can still go out west and see. They're amazing things, but they just don't talk about them.
Why don't you give your website right now?
Sure. My website is historic, historic truth, H-I-S-T-O-R-I-C, and that's one word, H-I-S-T-O-R-I-C, Historic Truth, T-R-U-T-H, one word, dot info, I-N-F-O. In other words, I'm getting information about the truth of history, information of truth in history. You can buy my books there. You can buy my T-shirt. I have a picture. I believe you had a picture there, my T-shirt with the Columbus standing there. What the picture is, Columbus is standing on the left-hand side of the cartoon. It's on the front of the shirt. And picture is a picture of the Nina, the Pinta, and Santa Maria in the background. And Columbus has just come in and planted his flag, and he says, I have on the top, it says, Columbus says, I claim this land for Spain. Under his feet, it shows 1492. And then right next to him, these Indians, these so-called Redskin Indians, are staying there, and they say, this is not your land, this is our land. And then a few feet away from the Indians are the Africans standing there with posters that, what do you mean, your land? So that is my book in a nutshell. Say a picture is worth a thousand words. That picture shows.
I have a caller.
Yes.
They're from the 843 area code. Can you please identify yourself?
I have a caller.
Yes. Turn down your speaker.
Can you hear me?
Yes. Who are you?
Yes, my name is Eddie. I'm in South Carolina.
Hi, Eddie.
Hello, Eddie.
Greetings. It's definitely a good time for your book. I haven't heard from you in a while. I remember you was on What's the Brother Show at night. His name is the same as yours, isn't it? David M. Hotep?
Michael N. Hotep in the Black History Network.
Yes. I've been trying to get in contact with you. I have a friend down here who does lectures from time to time. I'd like to see if what it would take for you to come down to speak to the family.
Well, that's what I do. That's how I make my living, lecturing and writing books. You can go to my website and find information there, how to get in contact with me, or you just Google my name. You don't have to Google it. Just put in, just write down now my email, and that's david.mhotep, my name, david.mhotep@gmail.com.
Okay.
I will respond to you.
Excellent. It's a beautiful show. Beautiful show. I appreciate both of you. I don't really have a question, but you definitely, that thing you just spoke about how we should communicate, I've never heard of that before, and that is awesome.
Awesome, and at the same time, elementary. And it's so simplistic, it is absolutely brilliant.
Yes, indeed. I got some information from the Moors as far as the electrical color system, how's it go? White is common, black is ground, and red is positive. That is ancient also, you know, and I'm sure that they probably got that information from here in the Americas because, you know, we're everywhere. Just like how they talk about Thomas Edison and electricity and things like that, you know, most of the castles, even in Egypt, you know, all those places were lit, you know, at night, should I say, if for lack of a better word, you know.
Yeah, there's evidence.
There's evidence.
I spoke about the batteries,
that,
the ancient batteries they found in a temple. I spoke about that earlier. Yes, indeed, they did have electricity. And there's one big, in one of the temples, I can't remember what temple it is, but they show a gigantic light bulb, and it has the wire with the wires coming out of it, and it goes into a little rectangular object that looks like a transformer. And this is really something. Oh, goodness. Okay. The filament inside the light, you will not believe what the filament is. It's an electric eel. The filament inside the light, eel. And this is on, people can find this online. I don't know what they would put in, but it's online, and it's in some books about ancient Egypt. So they're showing you right there that they had lights, light bulbs, and electricity. And I showed you, I spoke earlier about these several jars, gigantic jars, about a foot tall, and how they took them apart, and they saw all you have to do was add some lemon juice to that jar right now, and they got some electric current coming out of it, and they are thousands and thousands of years old. So that can be shown. You can find that on the internet as well somewhere, but you can definitely find it in my book.
Awesome. Yes, I definitely will start spreading the word again about your book. I tell you, just like what a lot of people are saying, we got to go back to the old ways and whatnot. You know, honor your mother and father. That way your days will be long on earth. This 2013 is definitely a magical time. Information is definitely coming out. The truth is definitely coming out. It's not about his story. It's about antiquity and the truth. And I esteem you, brother, and I definitely look forward to speaking to you real soon. I got
okay, well,
your
listen
name
to this,
down,
what
but,
you just spoke upon, and that is a spiritual system. Now, I don't talk about religion. I will talk about a spiritual system. Have you heard of the Dogon?
Yes.
Dogon people in Africa?
Yes.
Okay. Well, the Dogon, the short story on the Dogon was they were a group of Egyptians. They were part of the Egyptian Empire, which was many, different groups, tribal groups, but they were one of them. And they were the spiritual. They were very spiritual, even in Egypt. And their tales are that around 400 B.C., just before the big invasions of the Persians and Assyrians and different people like that started coming, and they knew that they were coming. Their fortune tellers, their oracles told them that they were coming. So they packed up and moved out and traveled a distance equal to from New York to California. They traveled through the Sahara because the Sahara was not always a desert. You know, at one time the Sahara had a network of rivers and gigantic lakes. One was Lake gigantic Mega Chad. Lake Chad is still there, but it was a gigantic lake at that time. And there was one in Libya as well. So they traveled all the way to Mali. And when they got to Mali, they did not choose the area. And Mali right now is at least half desert. They chose the area that was not filled up with a lot of beautiful green valleys and fruit trees and whatnot. They went into an area that wasn't as lush. And on the backside of that was a mountain area, mountainous area. So obviously they chose that so that they wouldn't have people coming to try to take their land. And probably the other lands were filled already with people who were living there, so they probably didn't want to interfere with them. So they went somewhere else where people wouldn't want to live. But even there, through the ages, they had to withstand 99 different attacks, and they were sieges. They went up and tried to when you put a siege on, you try to make them run out of food and water. Well, they went up into the mountains and obviously had a constant flow of water and some food from the animals, I guess, that were up in there. And what this means was, since they were never conquered, they brought with them all their Egyptian ways. They had their full culture intact. They had their language intact. They had their spiritual system intact. They had their writings intact. So if you fast forward this, Ivan Van Sertima used to give lectures all over, and I loved his work so much. I followed him around, and finally I was invited to a little group that he had afterwards, and he would have a handful of people in there to go into depth, and he told this story about how when he went to Africa, they loved his books, and they said, we want to induct you into a secret society. Now, up until then, I had thought, like the book, have you ever heard of a book called The Rape of the Nile?
Mm-hmm.
Well, there's a book called Rape of the Nile, and it shows how people, came down and burned things and chopped up the pillars and got rid of some of the smaller temples and defaced other temples and did things like that and stole everything out of Egypt, and then they pushed them out like the Egypt is right now is mostly Arabs. Okay, southern Egypt you still have some of the darker original people who were there, but he said that he was taken far out. They put a blindfold on him. He was taken way out in the bush. And then they went way down into the earth, and he said that when they took his blinders off, he said he cried. He said he was amazed at what he said. He said, "I took an oath. I cannot say what they showed me, but I can tell you, my friends." He says, "Nothing from ancient Egypt has been lost." Okay, so they have some of these places in different parts of the Dogon have gone to different parts of Africa, so that. If people want to destroy all of this information, it can't be destroyed because it's out and it's disseminated now. Plus, there are some places, a place now, like you said, you know what, Bruce Lee came out with Kung Fu. He was the first Asian to teach Kung Fu to other people, and some people think that he was killed for that. Well, this is the Enlightening Age. It's the age of Aquarius, you know, which just started last December, December 31st. We've gone into a different age as astronomical age, and this is the time where all these truths are supposed to come out. So Dogon sent a representative 10 years ago to America, a Dogon priest, and he opened up a place called. Well, first of all, I like to say that if Giza, the Giza Plateau, they have found that it's like if you put it on a map, it is the center of the world of north, south, east, and west, and they wrote about that in a book. I can't recall the book right now. I have it in my book, though. Wait a minute. It's about. I gotta give you the name of this book. It's called the Maps of the Ancient Sea Kings, and it shows in the Maps of the Ancient Sea Kings by Charles Hapgood. Okay, they show where that is true. What I just said it was like the Earth center. So. When he came over here, he started his group, and his group is called The Earth Center. And they have now they have a temple in Chicago, West Virginia, New York, and San Diego. And they just opened one up in London. And what this teaches the not no religion, no. They teach the spiritual system of the ancient Egyptians to anyone who wants to learn. White, black, Chinese, Mexicans. They welcome everyone because we're all children of the ancient Africans. We all came out of Africa. You can go to the place theearthcenter.com if you want to learn more about them. Theearthcenter.com. THEE, two E's together. THEEARTH center.com, and you can see about them. Now I'm going to a class there now, and I've learned a prayer, and this is ancient Egyptian. Now, a lot of these people out here teaching people how to read hieroglyphics, but they don't know how to speak it. These people have been speaking this since the beginning. They have taught this to the people who come and study at the Earth Centers. And here is a short Egyptian prayer. This is ancient Egyptian as it was spoken, and I get emotional every time I try to do this. Because it's ancient Egyptian, and its prayer goes like this: Duk heka'u pui ab imra'e cha'ati ra netru hare wati imra'e nuk ra'ayayu nuk bafe heka'u. I'm taking classes now to learn about these different things about the Dogon, and there are a lot of the information is there. And what sparked my comments to this was you talked about people trying to. Become better or something like that to but the old, ancient ways. Well, there are 10 commandments, just 10, and this society can't even follow those 10. Well, those 10 came from out of the Nile Valley, like everything came out of, and the Egyptians had the laws of Matos, the 42 negative confessions, but they came from the area a little south of Egypt, and the Egyptians themselves say, we came from the beginning of the Nile, and you know the Nile flows from Central Africa north. It says we came from the beginning of the Nile, where the god Hapi dwell, at the foot of the mountain of the root moon. Okay? So the foot of the mountain of the moon is in Kenya. And Uganda, there's another mountain moon there. That is, they're both close together. So that shows that they came from there. And those 42 negative confessions came from a longer list, and they are listed on the site. And it's called the 77 commandments, or the 77 laws of Tahuti. Or I'm in the beginning of the study, so I don't know the name. I should know the name. Let me look. The name is The Great Book of Divine Ordinances, the Code of Human Behavior. And in there it has the Ten Commandments are in there, and the 42 negative confessions of Ma'at are in there. So I'm sorry I went off that case, but people need to know about this organization.
Nah, brother, I esteem you. That's what knowledge does. You're speaking from the heart, and you being guided by the ancestors to bring out this information because it really needs to be. But I must say, the reason why I said that, because it's not just because it's in the Bible, but the Bible was manipulated, as we know, by King James and whoever, but overall, there's a lot of information in there that came from Africa, and we always got our proverbs and philosophies, we always did, and our culture was supreme. You know, if we would just take off our consciousness and just sit it anywhere in our body and be still, you know, some of that culture will come out, because there's a lot of things. I mean, think about what that statement, honor thy mother and father,
yes,
that way thy days will be long. Because, you know, if you violate laws of the universe, the laws of your parents, you know, you're going to have trouble in life. You know, you might wish you were dead, you know. I'm not just talking about, you know, mom and pa the way they used to be back in the day. Boy, you're going to mind. It ain't you're going to behave. You're going to mind. And if you don't, you know it's going to happen. You know, it's going to be repercussions. You know, so I do tend to use verses in the Bible for understanding, because, you know, when they so-called emancipated us into the government system, you know, that's one of the first books they gave us was the Bible. So it ain't about Michelangelo's cousin, you know, truly. But the information that's in that book, you know, it is our information. It is a shadow of our walk, you know.
Yes, it is.
So that's why I brought that out. And I definitely esteem you and appreciate, you know, the truth that you're giving us. But again, you are at David.mhotep at what?
Okay, David.mhotep at gmail.com.
Okay.
David.mhotep at gmail.com. And the website is historic, HISTORIC, truth.info, INFO. That's information about the truth about history, or historic truths.
Just for the audience to know, all of the information is embedded into the body of the description of this radio show. And Dr. Imhotep, I want to let you know you only have 7 minutes left.
Okay. Okay. Well, thank you very much, caller. I'm going to end up by giving a couple more little things. Thank you so much for calling, and please keep in touch.
Well, definitely will. ASAP.
Okay.
I esteem and appreciate you, and keep up your good work.
Okay.
Should I say your life
book,
work?
In the book, the last few, couple points I wanted to make was in South America, there people know about the Tiwanaku and the semi-terranean temples that are more than 12,000 years old. And people say, well, that's older than Egypt. Of course not, because the Egyptian Karnak, Temple of Karnak, they've shown, is 13,500 years old. And the Olmecs, I'm sorry, and the Earth Center, I have a magazine where they come out and they show where the Pyramid of Giza is 71,000 years old, which is a long way out. But to go further than that, if you want to go to an even older culture in Africa, South Africa, there is a book by Tillinger. Okay? And this book is called Temples of the African Gods. Temples of the African Gods by Tillinger. Temple of the African Gods. And in that book, he shows some amazing things. And he shows a civilization in Africa, an advanced, I won't say advanced, but it was a serious civilization, dating to 160 and 200,000 years ago. Now, where people say, whoa, wait a minute, that's crazy. Well, Homo sapiens have been existing for 200 to 200. I'm talking about modern Homo sapiens, from 150 to 250,000 years of age. Now that's a long time. That's a long time, and the civilizations have risen and fallen, risen and fallen, risen and fallen. And this one, his basis on that is the artifacts that he found, but also a everyone knows what Stonehenge looks like. Well, they had a type, and that's a calendar, by the way. Stonehenge is a calendar. They had a calendar in stone, still there, and they plugged that calendar in stone into a computer. And of course, the reason you make calendars, stone calendars, were just keep it's a gigantic clock. That's not just a clock for hours and minutes, but months and the years. And it shows when the time to plant, the best time to plant, the best time to harvest, when the equinoxes fall, when the different things in the planets, how they move, whatnot. They plug them into that computer, and it showed that those times matched the planets when they were between 160 to 200,000 years old. Walter, this is some amazing information, and this came. This is not in my book because it's something I was just given, and it's an amazing amount of information. So when we look at things in South America that are 12,000 years old, and then the Temple of Karnak being 13,500 years old, okay, we look at this, we say, oh my goodness, and phenomenal information. There was a city, and the city that encompassed this, they say, had to be at least twice as large as Los Angeles. They say, well, how would they feed all these people? They found close by, I don't know if people know, they've ever seen the terrace farming, the ancient terrace farming that they have in South America. Well, in South America, they have a lot of mountains, as well as in South Africa, and there aren't many valleys to grow food. So what they do is they cut a series of steps in the mountain. So because if you plant on the side of a hill, when it rains, it's going to wash your seeds and whatnot away. But if you go a series of steps up the mountain, it does not wash away. Now, they had that type of farming, terrace farming, way back then. They have a picture of this terrace farming, but it covers 160 square miles. So what intelligence figured out that could feed enough people to populate an area twice as many as Los Angeles. Then the last thing is they have found a series of these circular structures, and it's the base of the structure because the structures are gone, but they're all circular, but it seems that there's no doorway. Now, that is kind of weird. They don't know what those structures were built for, but there's no doorway. So I'm through, and I will sum up now my book, saying that my book shows that there was an ancient civilization in North, Central, and South America, and they were part of the ancient African antediluvian megalithic worldwide maritime civilization of Zebtepi. This came from Africa, from the Nile Valley, from where the whole human came from. And there's no such thing as race. There's no such thing as race. There's one race, and that is a human race. Some are short, some are tall, some are fat, some are small.
We're down to 1 minute,
some are light,
Doctor.
Some are dark. And that's it. Thank you very much for having me.
Well, outstanding. I appreciate all your contributions, and I hope that people will take the opportunity to purchase your book by going to your website and going to Amazon. We're planning on a series of different shows like this. We'll be back tomorrow with LeGrand Clegg, and he'll be talking about when black men ruled the world. And that's going to be at 11 a.m. Pacific time. We'll be having that show. And you can look forward to hearing more from Dr. Imhotep in the future. We're going to start a whole series of social media campaigns with him I want to thank everyone that called in and that's listening right now. Please forward this show to your constituents on Facebook and Twitter and email it to people and Google Plus it to help us get this fantastic information out to the public. Thank you once again, Dr. Imhotep, and everyone that called in. This is Walter Davis with the Citizens Internet Television Network, Diego County Community Coalition Radio Channel, and Media Communications Association International, Los Angeles and Orange County.